And yeah, so I went to college under the GI Bill. I went to college in the daytime and worked 4 to 12 shift in a warehouse loading trucks, because while the GI Bill was wonderful and generous, you might say, it still wasn't enough to keep you alive. So I had to work, and my wife had to work, and now we had two little kids, and they were in a nursery and so on. So I went to Columbia Graduate School, got a PhD at Columbia, and then my first teaching job was at Spelman College in Atlanta. And the next 7 years were in the South, and living in the black community of Atlanta, 1956 to 1963.
Which was when the civil rights movement was starting to take off.
Those were very important years. Of course, I had no idea when I went down there what it would be like. I was just looking for a job. It wasn't that I was looking for teaching a black college, I just looking for a job, and this job came along. Oh, a Negro college, never heard of it, but a job. So we packed up our old Chevy and went down, and that was probably the most educational experience of my life. Being in the South in those particular years, went down in 56, which was a year after the Montgomery bus boycott, and stayed until 63, and could see the development of the movement, and became involved with my students. Even before the sit-ins, we were making little forays, the students, I, little forays into Atlanta to against sort of symbols of racial segregation. And, and it was instructive. Instructive in showing, actually, that you could win little victories if, you stuck at it. And, for my students decide they wanted to desegregate the Atlanta Public Library. Libraries were segregated, like schools were segregated. And the main library in Atlanta, called the Carnegie Library, was only for whites. They decided they're going to try to get in. They would go to the library and ask for books. They said, we don't have these books in the black library. We'd like John Locke, An Essay on Human Understanding. We like John Stuart Mill, On Liberty. We like et cetera, et cetera. The librarians are getting more and more embarrassed. Librarians are sensitive people. I suppose that's why they become librarians, right? Librarians, they're not going to get angry and say, get out of here. They find all sorts of excuses, But this campaign went on and on, and finally they broke down. And they desegregated the library, which was a victory, amazing victory that just a handful of students had succeeded in doing. That was a lesson. And I became involved with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was formed in 1960, the sit-ins had taken place starting in February in Greensboro, North Carolina, and the sit-in spread to other cities in the South, spread to Atlanta the next month. And my students, my Spelman College students, very polite, very controlled. Spelman College was like a nunnery. The students, certainly I go to chapel six mornings a week, compulsory chapel. Yeah, they couldn't double date until it was a very controlled place, and the idea was to take these young black girls from the South and move them into the middle class, teach them manners, really, like finishing school, teach them how to pour tea, wear white gloves, really amazing. And what happened is when they got involved in the movement, and they broke out of Spelman College and went into the city where they had never really gone, because the city was a forbidding place. It was tightly, Atlanta was as tightly segregated as Johannesburg, South Africa. And but they went into the city and they sat in and they got arrested. And when they came back to the campus, they were on fire, rebelled against the administration, against the rules and regulations. It was fascinating to see the change from passivity and courtesy and deportment and from that to rebellion and anger. And so, yeah, I became involved with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which had formed out of the various sit-ins that had taken place throughout the South. And the SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, asked me to be on their executive board, along with one other person they considered an adult. We were the two adult advisors, I and a woman named Ella Baker, a black woman, a very sure. remarkable woman with a history of organizing in Harlem and with the NAACP, and very wise. And so, yeah, I became, a kind of writer and participant in the movement, doing both at the same time, going around from Atlanta, Georgia, to Albany, Georgia, where demonstrations were taking place, to Selma, Alabama, to various towns in Mississippi, Hattiesburg and Greenville and Greenwood and Jackson. And writing about this and participating in it. And as I said, it was an educational experience for me.
You were ultimately dismissed from Spelman College.
Dismissed. I like that word, dismissed.
In 1963,
we don't say fired in the academic world. We rarely say dismissed. We say, what do we say? We say, oh, this contract was not renewed. But yes, I was fired. Let's put it bluntly.
And you had tenure, so
I had tenure. I was a full professor. I was chair of the department. Well, when you ask how is that possible when you have tenure, it's like asking how can a policeman hit you with a club when we have a constitution? The law is one thing, power is another thing. And when I began teaching at Boston University, I taught a course called Law and Justice in America. And that was the theme of the course. This is law and this is justice. This is the law and this is power. And a very important thing to learn. So, yeah, I was fired despite the fact that I had tenure and was chair of the department and was a full professor. And I was fired, and they didn't send me my letter until June. They wanted to wait until all the students were off the campus and everything was quiet. And that's when the axe came down. And so my family and I picked up our belongings and went north. And, there was a sort of consolation prize that, along with the letters telling me goodbye, said, we'll give you 1 year's salary, $7,000, so we could live for the next year on $7,000, which we did. Actually moved up to Boston and had a year in which I did some writing and kept going back to the South and so on.
And after that time, you became more deeply involved in opposing the war in Vietnam. And
yeah,
in fact,
it was very good
role.
Timing.
So tell us about the work that you did, perhaps culminating in your trip to North Vietnam with Daniel Berrigan.
Oh, yeah. Well, becoming involved in the war, seemed natural. And here I was coming up north in 63, 64. And there was the August of 64, there's the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which is the precipitating incident that brings the escalation of the war. But as I said, I was still going down. My wife and I spent the summer of 64 in Mississippi, Freedom Summer, where people came from all over the country to work on the right to vote for black people and set up freedom schools for kids and did all sorts of things. And that was the summer in which that infamous incident took place with the murder of three civil rights workers, one black, two whites, Cheney, Shawna, Goodman. That took place in June. At least they disappeared in June. Their bodies weren't found until late July, beginning of August. Yeah, because we had, at the beginning of August, we had a memorial ceremony for them in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is where they had been arrested and from which they were dragged out and executed. And people came, people in the movement, in the civil rights movement, came from various parts of Mississippi to this memorial meeting. It was held out of doors. It was actually a beautiful day. And Mrs. Cheney, the mother of James Cheney, one of the guys who was killed, was there. And Bob Moses, who was the organizer, the SNCC organizer in Mississippi, a sort of a fabled organizer. And very quiet, but very courageous, and he got up on the platform at the memorial meeting, and he held up a newspaper, and it was that morning's Jackson, Mississippi newspaper, and the headline said, LBJ says, shoot to kill in the Gulf of Tonkin. And he said, so, ready to shoot to kill in the Gulf of Tonkin, half a world away, and federal government will not send anybody down here to Mississippi to protect civil rights workers, three of whom have just been killed. It was a very dramatic moment. And as you might say, the beginning, in a certain sense, of the anti-war movement, a convergence of the two movements. And in fact, you know, the anti-war movement drew a lot from the civil rights movement, drew a lot of the spirit and feeling and hostility to the national government, and people who were in the civil rights movement became involved in the anti-war movement. And I was there that day and became involved after, in what became a slowly growing movement against the war. In the spring of 65, which is a moment of important escalation in the war, we had a rally on the Boston Common against the war, and I spoke, and Herbert Marcuse, a political philosopher, spoke. 100 people. Wasn't a very big turnout, and I tell people about that when they complain that, oh man, you know, we're not having a big demonstration, look how many people showed up, people get disconsolate and so on. But yeah, 100 people. But then it grew. Yeah, 3.5 years later, another meeting on the Boston Common, and 100,000 people were there. So yeah, I became involved in, I just began, when I was teaching at Boston University, I was offered a job when I came that year that I was living luxuriously on our $7,000. I was invited to teach at Boston University, and so I was teaching at Boston University, and at the same time very active in the anti-war movement. And therefore, it wasn't easy for me to get tenure at Boston University because of that. It was a very tricky thing. But ultimately, I did. Although that's a story in itself, but I won't go into it. One of those academic stories, you know. You know how boring academic stories are. But, yeah, I do a lot of speaking, writing. Wrote an article for The Nation called Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. And Beacon Press, which had published my book on SNCC, suggested I write a book by that name, Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. Because there was no book, a fair amount had been written about the Vietnam War by 1967, but no book called for immediate withdrawal from Vietnam. And that was considered too radical. People talked about, oh, we can't withdraw precipitously. I love that word, precipitously. Even after you've been at war for 7 years, if you're going to leave, they say, oh, we mustn't be precipitous. So that's what they say now about the war in Iraq, right? We've been there, 6 years. No, we mustn't be precipitous. Afghanistan, we've been there 8 years, 9 years. No. So, yeah, I wrote this book, Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. And I had, just before writing the book, I'd been to Japan. I'd been invited by a Japanese anti-war group called Beheiren, Japanese anti-war group, invited to do a lecture tour of Japan about the war, sort of representing the peace, the anti-war movement in the United States. And they invited me, and they invited a young black guy named Ralph Featherstone, who I had worked with in SNCC in the South. The two of us did this lecture tour, sort of 13 Japanese cities in 13 days, from Hokkaido in the north down to Okinawa in the south, all the way through Japan, every night a different city. And that was a great experience. The Japanese were far more against the Vietnam War than the United States. I mean, interesting when you think of it. Oh, Vietnam, communism in Vietnam, a threat. Well, yeah, Japan is much closer. If anybody might be threatened, oh, Japan. You know, but no, that the Japanese didn't see communism as a threat. And they saw the war for what it was, an attempt to extend American power in Asia. So, yeah, so I'd been to Japan, and so I wrote this book, Vietnam, Logical Withdrawal, which immediately went into like 7 printings and was distributed at anti-war rallies and was taken up and, you know, got a fair amount of publicity. One thing, the last chapter of the book was a speech I wrote for Lyndon Johnson. Of course, he didn't ask for it, but, you know, that wasn't going to stop me. I'm going to write a speech for him. And the idea of the speech was because everybody's saying, well, we shouldn't be in Vietnam, but how can we get out? Just what you hear now about Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, we shouldn't be there, but surely we can't just leave. No, and, you know, it's as if somebody had broken into your house and you said, get out. Well, I can't just leave. I wrote the speech for Lyndon Johnson, in which he explains to the American people why he is ordering our troops to leave. Very convincingly. Convinced me. But apparently it convinced other people, and they reprinted the speech in newspapers, and there was a businessman in Ohio who distributed copies of my book to every member of Congress and president and vice president. Of course, it didn't stop the war, but so I was writing, speaking, And that's what my life consisted of. And in early 1968, the North Vietnamese invited what they described as a responsible member of the American peace movement to come to Hanoi and to pick up three American prisoners of war, flyers, who would be the first ones released by the North Vietnamese. It was January of 68. It was the time of the Tet holiday, also the time of the Tet offensive in Vietnam. But in honor of the holiday, they wanted to make a goodwill gesture, they said, and they would release three prisoners if some responsible member of the American peace movement would come. And so I was considered a responsible member of the American peace movement, and Daniel Berrigan also. So two responsible members, that's better. And I had never met Dan Berrigan, but I met him on the morning that we were going to take the flight to Hanoi together. Met him in an apartment in Greenwich Village, where we'd been briefed by David Dellinger and Tom Hayden, both of whom had been to Vietnam, to North Vietnam. And so, yeah, so Dan Berrigan and I flew halfway around the world to Hanoi, stopping in six different cities and on the way. And spent a week in Laos because the plane that was supposed to take us from Vientiane in Laos to Hanoi had not arrived because it was supposed to take off from Saigon. There was a certain special plane, ICC, International Control Commission plane, set up by the Geneva Accords, and that plane flew six times a month to Hanoi. That's a regular schedule, six times a month. Well, it was dangerous to fly to Hanoi. It flew from Saigon to Phnom Penh in Cambodia to Vientiane in Laos to Hanoi. And didn't arrive when we were supposed to arrive in Vientiane, where we were going to take it to Hanoi. It didn't arrive because the Tet Offensive had held it up in Saigon. The Viet Cong had taken over the airport, Tan Son Nhut Airport in Saigon. But finally, the plane arrived after an interesting week in Vientiane with Dan Berrigan, and I got to be real friends, got to real know one another. And then we flew to Hanoi, we picked up the three prisoners and brought them back to Vientiane. And anyway, after that, Dan Berrigan became very involved in the anti-war movement and, the Catonsville Nine and all sorts of actions of civil disobedience. And I continued to be involved in the movement.
And one thing that quite a few people may not know is that you, and through you, Noam Chomsky, played a role in the release of the Pentagon Papers by Daniel Ellsberg. Mm. These, of course, being top secret U.S. documents that documented the United States' intentional misleading of the U.S. public around Vietnam. Tell us about how you became involved in the release of the Pentagon Papers, which really galvanized opposition against the war.
Well, I'd like to exaggerate my role, of course, but I'll try to tell the truth. I got to know Dan Ellsberg when he left the Rand Corporation, left the government, and had a kind of some sort of fellowship at MIT. And this was around 1970. And so I met him at one of these anti-war rallies, and we hit it off. We became friends, and he and his wife, Pat, I and my wife, we came again going out together. And one time we were visiting him. He and Pat had an apartment in Cambridge near Harvard Square. I don't know if you know this area, but we visited them in their apartment, and Dan said, I'd like to show you something. he had a sense of the drama. You know, Dan Ellsberg is a very dramatic guy. I mean, actually, he does dramatic things which hardly require over-dramatizing, but that's not going to stop him. He will dramatize the already dramatic, you know. Anyway, so he told me, he said, you know, I and my friend Anthony Russo, who also worked for the Rand Corporation, they had ordered this secret history to be put together of the Vietnam War, which to do it for the Defense Department. I had worked on it, and Tony Russo, and we decided we would photocopy 7,000 pages and make it public. And he brought out a bunch of this paper. So would you like to have some? And it's like, you know, like, would you have to, like, have a drink or something like that? A polite thing to do. I said, yeah. So anyway, I took charge of some of these papers and shortly after that, I guess it was, you know, early 71, that Dan Ellsberg and his wife Pat and Roz and I were going out to a movie together. We were going to see Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which I think Dan Ellsberg had seen 6 times. And when they came over to pick us up, we had a little apartment in Newton. And when they came to pick us up, Dan Ellsberg was very obviously agitated. What's the matter? Well, he says, you know, I gave copies of the Pentagon Papers to all these newspapers, the Times and the Post and so on, and none of them had done anything with it. But tomorrow morning, the Times is going to print a bunch of the paper. So I said, why are you upset? He said, because they didn't tell me. And this was Saturday night. That Sunday, the next day, the Times, big headline. And then, of course, then the government began looking frantically for the person who had released these papers, and for a while it wasn't known. Then somebody exposed the fact that it was Dan Ellsberg, and then began looking for him, and he went underground. And in the meantime, while he was underground, some of us were distributing his papers to other newspapers, and I played a part in distributing the copy of the papers to the Boston Globe, which then printed it, and then he, at a certain point, he decided to surrender to the FBI and his little, you might say, little party in front of the federal building in Boston, where he and Pat showed up, and the FBI was there, and they were a little embarrassed because they hadn't known where he was, and, you know, and so he was arrested, and he was put on trial in Los Angeles, and I was asked to be a witness in a trial, because one of the things that had to be done in a trial was to explain to the jury what was in the Pentagon Papers, because the jury was being told by the government to release these documents, a danger to the security of the United States. I mean, that's the basis for the indictments. And he was indicted on 13 different counts for 10 years each, 130 years in jail. His friend Tony Russo had helped him. He was also indicted. And so they had his trial out in L.A. in 73, and I went out to L.A. to testify in the trial. My job was to tell the jury what was in the Pentagon Papers. So I actually had an opportunity to give a 4-hour lecture to the jury on the history of the Vietnam War, and to explain to them how this, releasing this, was not dangerous to national security. It was just embarrassing to the U.S. government. And that's why he didn't want it released. And told them what was in. Because the jury did not have the papers in front of them. Papers had to be introduced as exhibits, you see. So I had a job of telling him, you know, this is what's in the papers. This tells you that the United States created the government of South Vietnam, which we claimed we were coming in to help them. No, we brought Mr. Diem, the head of the South Vietnamese government, from New Jersey to Vietnam, set him up, gave him something to drink. So the trial took place, and an interesting trial. The government put on witnesses to say, yeah, this is a danger, and so on. But then in the midst of the trial, the scandal broke around the Nixon administration and the Watergate scandal. And it turned out that Nixon had ordered his team of official thugs to break into the psychiatrist's office, Dan Ellsberg's psychiatrist. And because Nixon wanted to get something out, to show he was a nut, right? And if somebody has visited a psychiatrist, he must be a nut. Not like Nixon. The break-in, the news of the break-in, and the judge in the trial said, no, we can't let the trial go on. It's tainted by what the government did. So that was the end of the trial. So that Dan Ellsberg since then has been very, very active in movement against nuclear weapons and been arrested many times.